The Juneau Access Road is again up for debate, and Skagway moves ahead with a land purchase for a future waste and recycling site. It's the KHNS Local News. I'm Margaret Friednauer. Those stories and more up next. Juneau residents last week weighed in for and against a $35 million appropriation for the Juneau Access Project in Governor Sean Parnell's proposed capital budget. The Senate Finance Committee took general comments on the spending plan. Those who spoke about the proposed road north of Juneau were split about evenly between supporters and opponents. James Sullivan, a spokesman for the Southeast Alaska Conservation Council, called the project a boondoggle.
We have felt for decades now that this project has been overblown in its usefulness and that it won't really serve the people of Juneau as well as many people think.
Sullivan asked the committee to pull funding for the project until the Alaska Department of Transportation comes out with a supplemental environmental impact statement. In 2006, SEAC challenged the original Juneau Access EIS in court, saying it didn't adequately consider alternatives to the road, such as improved ferry service. After several appeals, the Parnell administration started working on the new version in 2011. In early March, a DOT spokesman said a draft document could be released within a couple months. Supporters of the road say it would improve Juneau's economy and quality of life. Juneau Chamber of Commerce CEO Kathy Romick urged the committee to fully fund Parnell's request.
This $35 million will get the road as far as the Kensington Mine. That means that over 200 workers out there can drive home every day instead of staying in small rooms and cots that other employees share. And to us, that's really important because we want to keep those Kensington Mine workers and all of our mine workers here in Juneau.
Opponents say the state should not be building the road for a private company. Sometimes called the Lynn Canal Highway, the entire project is supposed to go to the Katsahine River, where day boats would transport vehicles and passengers to Haines and Skagway. Juneau Mayor Merrill Sanford and Deputy Mayor Mary Becker also testified in favor of the project. Haynesboro Mayor Stephanie Scott says there are more important things the state should be spending money on. For instance, the need that several communities, including Haines, has for improved sewer and wastewater treatment facilities. She said she has also asked the Senate and House Transportation Committees to take another look at the West Side Road option, which she thinks is a preferable route because it would open up a lot of opportunity for development of land on that side of the inlet and potential port opportunities. But more importantly, she says it would provide a hard link to Gustavus and Glacier Bay National Park and have more benefits for the entire state. More testimony is scheduled on the capital budget this week. The Skagway Assembly voted unanimously last week to offer the borough manager position to Scott Hahn of Colorado. Hahn was in Skagway last week for a community meet and greet and to have a public sit-down interview with the Assembly Thursday morning. The Assembly went into executive session for about 45 minutes during its regular meeting Thursday night to discuss Hahn. On Friday, Mayor Mark Schaefer said he made a formal offer to Hahn, who traveled home to Colorado over the weekend. Schaefer said he expected to hear back early this week from Hahn about if he accepted the position. The Assembly also briefly touched on the idea of creating a port director position for the municipality. Schaefer said there was likely to be funding set aside for a position in the upcoming budget, although not all the details were yet fleshed out. But the topic came up while discussing the condition of the ore dock. The Longshoremen Union recently sent a letter to White Pass and the municipality about a missing catwalk on the dock. Schaefer said interim manager Emily Deitch was planning on communicating with White Pass about the company's long-range repair plan for the dock and seeing when immediate fixes to the catwalk would be completed. The Assembly also agreed to go ahead with purchasing 15 acres from Hamilton Construction, pending a plat survey. The property fits with the town's plan to develop a single solid waste and recycling site, and the Assembly unanimously agreed the offer from Hamilton to sell the land to the city for about $1.6 million, was a reasonable offer. Assemblyman Steve Burnham noted that under the solid waste and recycling plan, the city could use about 10 of the acres to eventually build a new waste facility that could also encompass composting, brush piles, scrap metal and junk cars, and a transfer and recycling center, with possible other public work facilities on the site. That would leave about 5 acres for another use. Assemblyman Spencer Morgan mentioned it might be possible to relocate the Garden City RV park there, freeing up that current property, now owned by the municipality, for other options, such as creating more housing. Finally, the Assembly discussed a recent visit to town by Yukon company Northern Cross. The company extracts crude from its leases near Eagle Plains in northern Yukon. It is looking at port facilities to export crude beginning next year. Company representatives toured Skagway port facilities, and the Assembly agreed it would keep discussion with the company open. Northern Cross has also visited Haynes and talked to Delta Western about export facilities. Northern Cross has also visited Haynes and talked to Delta Western about export possibilities. It wants to ship the crude to Pacific Northwest refineries. The company has also invested in natural gas exploration, another possible export market it could create for either town. Representatives from Northern Cross did not respond to requests for comment. The Haynesboro Assembly meeting Tuesday night begins with a budget workshop at 5:30. The meeting is also the first with new manager Dave Sosa on the job. Ordinances up for discussion or adoption include one to repeal permitting for commercial passenger vehicles. Another would up the limit the borough manager has for making purchases without a resolution from the Assembly. Under unfinished business are the two items that will likely get the most attention and discussion at Tuesday's meeting. The first is finalizing the legal reasoning the Assembly used to overturn a conditional use permit appeal for a private heliport off Chilkat Lake Road. Once that is finalized and approved by the Assembly, it sets in motion a timeline for an appeal process. Some residents of Eagle Vista Subdivision have said they do plan on appealing the Assembly's action in State Superior Court. Also, the Assembly will discuss how the borough should monitor or test the impact of the planned heliport, mainly for noise. The conditional use permit is for 1 year and includes the requirement that monitoring takes place. The Assembly will also discuss eight other ordinances or resolutions and the suggestion of conducting a winter tourism study. For a complete agenda and meeting packet, visit the Haynesboro website. The Assembly meets Tuesday starting at 5:30 for an overview of the FY15 budget, followed by the regular meeting at 6:30 in Assembly chambers. A recent study suggests that current herring populations in Southeast Alaska and British Columbia may be just a remnant of what once existed. Archaeologist Madonna Moss has studied sites in and around Southeast Alaska for decades. She says that evidence gathered by researchers up and down the coast indicates that herring were once far more widespread and far more abundant than they are today. And she says fishery managers should look to the past when making decisions about the present. KCAW's Rachel Waldholtz reports.
Moss is part of a team of scientists who pulled together data from 171 archaeological sites stretching from Yakutat to Puget Sound. They identified nearly 500,000 different fish bones from the sites, some of which are nearly 10,000 years old. And what they found was a lot of herring. The team found herring bones in all but two of the sites. And Moss says,
herring bones were the most numerous bones in most of the sites. And that was a surprise because on the Northwest Coast, if you ask what fish is the most important, people will, of course, they'll say salmon.
The team found herring bones everywhere, in places where you find large populations of herring today, and, more tantalizingly, in lots of places where you won't find herring today, but where oral histories or place names imply herring were once present.
And that is a significant finding in that it helps illustrate how the spatial distribution of herring has contracted into fewer localities, whereas in the past, herring bones were really widespread in archaeological sites. So there's been a spatial constriction of where herring are abundant.
In all, nearly half of the fish bones collected from the sites were from herring. The team concluded that the only way you'd see that number of herring bones in that many sites is if herring populations in the past were far larger and far more widespread than they are now. And that, they argue, should influence how the populations are managed today. That hypothesis isn't accepted by many fishery managers, but it aligns with what many in the Sitka tribe have said for a long time.
I think that the archaeological work in this case really does support the life experience of people who've been fishing herring and watching the herring and collecting eggs for a very long time.
The paper was published in February in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. The lead author is Ian McKechnie of the University of British Columbia. It's a follow-up to a major project by Moss and other researchers, first published in 2010, that pulled together archaeological data, oral histories, and biological and historical records to try to piece together a map of where herring were known to spawn in Southeast Alaska before the advent of industrial fishing. This most recent paper was in part an attempt to extend that map down the coast, focusing in particular on British Columbia. Moss says that many factors influence herring populations. That includes pollution, climate change, and the rebounding populations of predators like whales and sea lions. But she personally thinks that industrial fishing in the late 19th and early 20th centuries had a much more severe impact than modern managers assume.
I think that huge numbers of herring were taken out of the system years ago, and then there was kind of a lull, and the fisheries recovered. And then it was in the 1970s that becomes kind of the baseline that many fishery scientists rely on. And so if you compare the herring numbers to the 1970s, they might not look so bad. But if you go back 150 years, they look pretty paltry.
And if you go back 1,500 years, it might look even more so. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Rachel Waldholz.
For KHNS News, I'm Margaret Friednauer. Special thanks to Casey Kelly and Rachel Waldholz for help with this report. Thanks for joining us for your local news on KHNS. We appreciate your support.